Hi, I'm Kyra Kellawan, an international educator with experience of careers and college counselling in schools and universities across four countries. You're listening to the Piloted Podcast, a show about innovation in education for teachers, parents, and students. Hello, and welcome back to episode 5. This week's conversation is with Ben Fugel and Tim Milner, two educators who are friends, who are both working in atypical teaching and learning contexts, and who are both part of a group that's working to develop Orceros, a new kind of school that has paired everything back to two essential questions. What is school, and what should school be for? I worked with Ben for 2 years at the residential United World College in San Jose, Costa Rica, where he's the IB coordinator and teaches global politics. We became firm friends who worked alongside one another and students from over 75 countries in a 2-year program that goes far beyond the usual academic profile of a school in favor of a more holistic education that offers 3 separate strands, which Ben will explain later. My first introduction to Tim, therefore, was from Ben. I think he knew that when I read the manifesto, it would be something that instantly filled me with both joy and curiosity about this project. So Orceros describes itself as a school that will challenge conventional thinking and facilitate self-directed learning, encouraging individual creativity and nurturing the development of the whole person. I asked Ben and Tim to introduce themselves to the listeners, and as you'll see, everything started with a friendship that then evolved to become a meeting of minds as educators.
Okay, so at the minute, I'm IB coordinator at United World College in Costa Rica, and I've been here for 5 years. So doing that, that's about 50% of the job. The other 50% teaching global politics. Prior to that, several years bouncing around the world, West Africa, East Africa, Hong Kong. 2 years in sunny Runcorn in Cheshire. Yeah, prior to that, a glittering career in the Lancaster entertainment industry, which was how Tim and I met.
Yeah, let's explain that connection for the listeners. How do you two know each other?
Well, Ben and I go back quite a number of years now, probably nearly 20 years, and we worked together, like you say, in the glittering and dizzy heights of the entertainment industry in Lancaster in the northwest of England. That's where we met. Ben and I worked at the same nightclub. That's where we got our friendship built, I guess.
Was that pre or post teacher training or during?
That was definitely pre for me.
Yeah, pre for me as well.
I think quite a number of us eventually went on to become teachers in one capacity or another. I retrained as a teacher. When I left university, I worked in nightclubs for a number of years and then retrained to be a primary school teacher after spending a couple of years working in a classroom as a teaching assistant. Then made the move to secondary school, worked as a secondary school science and PE specialist for about 12 years. And now I work for a lovely organisation where we teach students who are on the periphery of education. So we teach students with educational barriers to learning, educational care and health plans, and we keep them in the education groove.
And so I obviously came to know about you, Tim, through Ben. And Ben was telling me about this WhatsApp group for educators who wanted to design something different. Could you tell us a little bit about what that project is?
How you
to be involved?
We are a group of approximately 20 educators who have come together to rethink how the current system works. It came together through a number of conversations with frustrated educators about the frustrations with the current education system, very fixed, very rigid system that we currently have. And it started with a meeting, just a small number of people, a dozen people or so, parents, educators, people who were interested in seeing and activating change. And we got together, we talked about some of the issues, but the main kind of focus of the meeting was, what would happen if we just started again? What would happen if we started a system, an education system, with a blank piece of paper?
Much before COVID. This is long before COVID.
Yeah, we're going back 2 years now. So yeah, very much pre-COVID. So we said, what would happen if we started with a blank slate, clean sheet, and we put the student in the middle, and we only added to the experience for the student what was going to benefit the student. And we wanted not to consider anything as a foregone conclusion. So we didn't even consider a building. We didn't even consider educators, teachers, classes. And what we moved towards is a system that we feel can certainly springboard, not because of the COVID, but we can use this as an opportunity to create a new normal, create a new and better system for students. So we're in the process of trying to open a school with a new type of education system based around creating and helping students to become the best versions of themselves, rather than become homogenous blobs put out at the other end of a very fixed and rigid education system. So what we decided to do was embark on a ridiculous adventure to open a school and start with the student in the middle and only put into practice the things that improved the student and gave them that really holistic, well-rounded experience from school, where they could learn how they wanted to learn. They could show their learning in ways that made sense to them.
And so this project was given a name, and I came to know it as Oceras.
Oceras, yeah. From the Latin verb to dare to do.
And it's going to be a school based in the UK, isn't it? In the north, yes, of England initially.
The idea is that, we're still in the kind of early to mid stages of developing this idea. We're looking at, because the majority of the people who are involved are located around that area, it makes sense to kind of have it based in that area in the first instance. We're very keen for it to be a physical school, but obviously the shift to this idea of blended learning, moving between remote and online teaching and learning, allows us to create a system where one flows from and to the other. We're not stuck with rigid classrooms that students have to be in at a certain time with a certain group of people learning a certain topic off the curriculum.
Mm-hmm. So Ben, as an educator based in Costa Rica, could in fact be part of this and is part of this vision. What's your involvement been so far, Ben?
I mean, Tim asked me if I wanted to get involved initially in the WhatsApp group. And to be honest, a lot of it in the beginning was sort of a selfish motivation, because a lot of the kind of ideas and stuff that pop up, you sort of take those, go back to your own school with them, and kind of develop your own practice with it. I mean, I've kind of been involved in it now probably about a year and a half. Now that the discussion has kind of moved on from very kind of blue sky thinking to actually, well, how would you implement this almost in kind of practical terms? It's interesting, because I think I was never convinced that it would work. And the longer it goes on, the more you sort of think, actually, there's something in this, you know?
So what changed your mind? What have you seen? What's been the development that means that this has moved along to a point where now you feel it's actually real?
Well, I think what's kind of interesting from my point of view is, in every other school or every other educational setting that I've worked in, you'll sit in these meetings and you kind of talk about, let's do this. And you'll have another sort of 5 or 6 or 10 people on the table. And the majority of those will come up with reasons why it won't work. And I think one of the strengths of this group is that you have a group of people who, I mean, you will always get, you know, somebody thinking in more practical terms, but you tend to get people thinking, all right, I like the idea. How do we make it work? Or how does it kind of fit into the bigger picture? So I think that's kind of where it's very different. And also the other thing is that certainly appeals to me, the idea that in most schools and being involved now in kind of scheduling and timetabling, we kind of have a plan, you know, the students have to fit along the schedule, or the students have to fit around the kind of constraints of the campus. So being able to start it again from scratch and to kind of say, well, how do we design a campus that fits around the needs of the students, or how do we staff a school in response to the needs of the students, rather than filling a school with students that fit with the needs of the staff that you have, almost. Mm. And I mean, one example of how that's kind of been developed, and Tim kind of touched on it earlier, is the idea that not necessarily how do you build a campus around students. Do you need a campus?
Right.
Is, I guess, the sort of first starting point.
We're seeing that school doesn't have to be a building right now.
One of the things that Tim says a lot, and I mean a lot, and I think he's right, is the idea that you've got to move away from the idea of school as a kind of building or school as an institution or school as a place and start thinking of school in terms of relationships. So a school is effectively, it sounds pretentious to say it, but like a web or a network of relationships. And if you think of it in those terms, that to me makes a lot more sense as an educator, or certainly the educator that I want to be.
So the time that we have now, you know, it's been, I don't know how many days you've both been in your respective lockdown situations. For us, it's 44 today. The time that we've had to sort of rethink what school looks like every day, week in, week out, we've heard a lot of trying to do things, trying to keep sort of the wheels spinning, trying to keep, you know, synchronous learning going, trying to keep contact and during timetabled contact hours. Teachers are speaking about real burnout as well, just trying to sort of deliver their same lessons to the same groups of kids at the same times and keep up with their own family lives. What do you think are the current changes that are sort of playing out now that we might be able to hang on to for the good of school? So rather than thinking about, okay, the model that you were just spoken about, keeping everything kind of running in the framework that it was, that perhaps wasn't serving the need of the student first, what changes do you think have happened already, or maybe you can foresee happening in the near future? It might mean that the student experience changes.
I think one that I've seen on a sort of personal level is because the school that I'm at, and we're a diploma program school, so effectively sixth form in international terms, our second years, because there are no exams this year, now that they've submitted their coursework, what do we do with them? We've got kind of 6 weeks, 2 months. And what I've sort of realized is what we've done by taking away the exams, we've actually sort of completely changed the way that we work, because traditionally we're teaching to an exam, we're working towards an exam. So one of the things that we've kind of come up with for our second year students is we've got 2 months where we want to do something meaningful that's going to help them when they go to university. So we're actually sort of developing the idea of what at the minute we're calling passion projects, which is effectively the students will decide what they want to learn and what they want to investigate. And they're approaching teachers to help them with that. So if we've got students, for example, that are interested in the sciences or in biology, they're designing their own project. And they're basically saying, I've got 2 months that I can learn something and develop my understanding and hopefully, you know, make a difference in something that I'm passionate about. And I think in an ideal world, and I mean, obviously, you know, all the practical implications that go with it, that's what learning should look like.
How many students have opted to do that? Or have any of them needed pushing? Because I think one of the main questions would be, how many put their hands up to do that? And I know, having worked with you, Ben, that the profile of those students are real go-getters. They're people who had to get through a selection process to be there. They want to be there.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not necessarily going to work in every context, but that's because these kids are 16, 17, 18 years old. If you can start that model at an earlier age, which the work that Tim and his group are doing, if you're getting these kids from year 7 onwards, 11 years old, and you're kind of getting them into that mindset already, by the time they reach 16, they should be pretty comfortable with the idea of them being the ones in the lead.
Well, this is it, exactly. What we're trying to do is take 11-year-old students, work with them through to the age of 18, and work with them in that kind of similar passion project idea, and getting them to think and develop and work towards trying to answer really interesting questions, questions that they're passionate about, questions that they choose, they decide their direction on, they decide the kind of pathway that they're going to take. And unpicking that, I mean, from Ben's point of view, you've got students who are, like you say, very passionate to be there. So that's certainly a bonus for you guys. In the British education system, it's a little bit different. You touched on the idea that the exams are now cancelled. We've done that in the UK, obviously, as well. And it's suddenly become the thing that teacher assessment is now a lot higher weighted when it comes to the students' final grades. So it's based on mock exams that they've done during the previous 12 or 18 months. But the teacher assessment has now become really important. I think one of the changes that we can really grasp hold of, a real positive change that we can grasp hold of and take forward, is the idea that teacher assessment has to be held aloft. It has to be held up there as a kind of beacon as to how we do it. I agree with Ben wholeheartedly when we say that it's about relationships. We're in the business of building positive relationships, and nobody knows the students like the teachers do in an educational capacity. So getting them to kind of put their mark on where the students are, I think that's a really positive thing that we can carry forward.
I think that leads back to something you said, Ben, about a school being a web or being a network of connections too. And I think one of the great pieces of potential we have with this sort of online, more connected form of learning is not just connecting students together, but connecting educators together. And, you know, project-based learning works best, I think, when you have a sort of external audience or you have a real challenge or a real question that seems to have some kind of meaning in the real world. And I just think of the possibilities then of assessment being done by other schools, other teachers, by kind of peer review for students working on projects that are then, you know, looked at by somebody whose passion is as great as their own. And maybe that person isn't in their own physical school. Maybe it's somebody else who's out there in the world.
I think linked with that, and I mean, Tim's done a little bit of work on this, but it doesn't necessarily have to be solely educators.
Absolutely.
You know, you kind of get involved with local businesses, universities, higher ed, all of these kinds of things have got a role to play.
Absolutely. That's one thing that we're doing at Oceros. We're lucky. We very much want to be an outward-facing school in that, within a traditional model of a school, you will have your expertise group within there, and that's where you will take your expertise from the teachers and the educators within there. We want to be very much outward-facing insofar as working very closely with universities, with charities, with businesses. We've made a lot of positive connections, and the one thing that we're hearing from universities and from businesses in particular is that a lot of students who are leaving school have been taught what to learn rather than how to learn. And the problems that they're facing is they're coming in with this array of grades, but not actually having the skills of creativity or problem solving or a passion for learning and learning something new. That's what we want to kind of combat at Oceros. We want to change that so that the students lead their own learning. They know what they're passionate about. They follow that. And when faced with a problem, they know how to approach it. They know that they can say, well, I don't know the answer to it yet, but I can ask these questions. I can find that information here. So become curious individuals.
How different will it be from quote unquote normal school, Tim? What's the kind of learning experience that you foresee for a typical student who's in your first year class, for example?
We want to get away from this idea of learning in discrete subjects. We want to do interdisciplinary, multi-subject project-based learning. So I was really interested to hear your previous episode with David Price and Claire Price, who are just done some fantastic work with project-based learning. So we want students to follow projects. We want them to follow projects that they're passionate about, that they have their own questions about. So very similar to Ben's passion projects at his school. We want to think about a kind of cross-year group, if you will. So students not actually working with people of their own age, but working with lots of different students from lots of different ages. Why do we feel the need to batch students by year and by age? It simply goes back to the idea that we've got this factory line process where when you've been processed in year 7, you go into year 8, then into year 9, and you follow that machine, that factory-like process. So we want to get away from that as well. We definitely want to make learning personalised, and we want to make assessment personalised as well. Assessment very much should be about a conversation rather than what can be put into a spreadsheet. So this is a constant conversation that the students have with each other, that they have with the businesses and the charities that they're working with, and also redirection if needed by the teachers within the school as well. Having worked for a dozen years or so in secondary education, I've worked with some of the most fantastic educators who are unfortunately kind of feel shackled by the idea that the end of the tunnel, there is these standardized written tests which all students have to go towards. And actually what they want to do is spend time developing the student as a person. Are they a caring citizen in their community? Do they show compassion? Can they accept and take criticism and receive it and give it? It's about making the whole student, the whole rounded student, our focus.
So I'm going to come back to you in a second, Tim, on something that I know you're quite passionate about, which is badges and kind of gaining recognition for skills in a different way. But I think, Ben, could you tell us a little bit? I think you will have a lot of experience on sort of building that whole student on the kind of three parts of the UWC process that I know I'm familiar is about more than just the academic.
I mean, certainly at UWC Costa Rica, we've got the three pillars or the three strands to the students 2 years. So they've got the academic side of it, which in our case is the IB diploma. They've got the co-curricular side of it, where they're expected to, you know, bring in the creativity, the activity, the service element of it, and the residential. And the residential aspect is possibly the hardest to kind of quantify, but that's the part that links into the skills that Tim's talking about, you know, the skills of empathy, the skills of actually acknowledging and understanding the position of someone else. And that's not necessarily the same as agreeing with it.
Right, of living with each other and of living with people who are from very different backgrounds to your own.
Yeah, I mean, UWC, I think at its most fundamental is such an interesting project, because the idea is we take students from as many diverse backgrounds as we possibly can, economically, linguistically, culturally, whatever. We put them onto a relatively small campus in close proximity to each other for 2 years and say, get on with it. And then we're there as the safety. I think why that's really interesting, and that's one of the strengths of UWC, and I think it would be one of the strengths of a service. There was an expression I read somewhere, I can't remember where it was now, but it's this idea of almost sort of active caring neglect. You let the students take the lead, let them get on with it, and we're the sort of safety net or the guide to keep them roughly headed in the right direction. But how they get there is kind of up to them. And we had some sort of interesting discussions in our group about assessment. So I completely agree with Tim's point. This idea of having a standardized assessment, be it a GCSE exam or A-level or key stage exams or whatever, is ridiculous. So we try to move away from that. One of the ideas that we've discussed, I'm not sure we've necessarily got that much further on it yet, is what's wrong with letting students decide how they're assessed? And you can even take that to an extreme and you say to students, right, this is going to be your project. What do you want to do? How are you going to do it? What is going to be your criteria for success? How are you going to measure how successful you are? And that's a massive shift from what we do at the moment, because I would struggle to think of a school that I've seen or certainly ever been in where we don't say to students, this is how you will be assessed. So the idea of letting students themselves decide how they'll be assessed, letting the students decide what weighting they put on certain things and essentially what do they value, I think is a really interesting one and one that's definitely worth exploring.
So that leads us very nicely back to the idea of, first of all, are educators okay with that? Or is that terrifying for most teachers who are out there working in the world right now? And then how would you envisage students being able to be measured then in that way by the things that they deem to be important? So with the kind of Mozilla badges way of assessing mastery of something, how would you engage students to decide what was important to them? And what would that process be like in Osiris?
So the current situation that we've got, obviously, is that in the most case, students will engage in their learning in their educational setting, school, what have you, and they will be taught towards a standardized written test at the end of it. But what does that actually show? That shows what they can retain in the memory, and then they can regurgitate in a very limited way when it comes to a high-pressure, high-stakes testing situation. Now, is that the best way for students to show the best of themselves? I don't think it would take much convincing to say that it wasn't. But unfortunately, it's the worst phrase in the world, isn't it? We've always done it that way. And what we need to do, we should see this dreadful global pandemic almost as a kind of opportunity for us to change what we are doing and say, well, what's the new normal going to look like? What can we make it look like? How can we improve this going forward? What we're working towards with Osiris is looking at the possibility of using Mozilla Open Badges. These are simple image files which any organization, a charity, a school, a business can award to somebody who undertakes some learning or a course of some form. But most importantly, you can bake in data into there. So you can put in files, you can put in podcasts that you've created, you can put in essays, you can put in videos, you can put in where this badge was achieved it, who awarded it, all the data that you need. These are then open source, so you can carry them around, you can take them from institution to institution, from business to business, and you can build your online learning backpack. And we think that's a much more flexible way. Coming back onto something Ben said about the students being able to choose their method of assessment, one thing we want to do is, because we're working with universities and charities and businesses, instead of having these traditional high-stakes do-or-die written assessments at the end, what we're looking to do is invite these businesses, parents, charities in and almost allow the students to showcase what they've done. Here's where I'm at. This is what I'm doing. This is what I've done. This is where I failed, and this is what I learned from it. Because that's so important for the students to be allowed to fail, to be given that autonomy to fail and to improve next time.
And Ben, how do you foresee it changing at UWC, if it would? Is it something that you think about doing when the students enter and they would decide what their metric of success is, if they decide to do the IB route or if they decide to do something else? Would that be a reality?
In the short term, I suspect not. But certainly, you know, longer term, I think it's the way that any movement or any educational organisation that would regard itself as progressive has to be going. The one thing that's evident, I mean, this has come out through the previous episodes that you've done as well, is that the current system is not fit for purpose. And again, it's going back to this idea that Tim mentioned of it's the kind of assembly line model of education. And you only have to talk to virtually any employer, and students are not leaving with skills. They're leaving with more emphasis on knowledge than skills. So for me, the kind of key thing is applicability. And I think in any school where you're going to have students who are successful as learners, you have to provide multiple opportunities for failure. Because essentially, a student who turns up to a class straight sevens or straight A's or whatever the top grade is in whatever system, what's that student learning? Arguably, it's a student who starts off and fails repeatedly, but every time is failing in a different way or is getting a little bit better. So to me, I think the idea of failure is a really interesting one that you've kind of got to integrate into any sort of successful model of education.
I think that with us, Ceres, partnering with businesses, universities, charities and such like, and inviting them in to enable the students to show their learning, to show their knowledge, to show their understanding, it also helps them to see problems that are occurring in the real world, questions that need answering, and showing them that there might not always be a definitive answer as well, giving them the idea that, okay, given the time and the resources that you've got, what's your best answer to this question? What's your best answer to this problem that needs solving? And I think giving students that open-endedness, I think will stand them in a very good position to become better human beings and also for the world of work. We talk a lot about school being preparation for the world of work, but it's not solely about that. We've got to be really careful about that. Certainly, they've got to be productive members of society, but it's also about them helping them to become good human beings, good people in society, not just additions to the GDP of the country.
One of the things that I think chimes with me about what UWC do is that social piece, that CAS at UWC is not just CAS, it's more about local projects, getting involved with organisations and charities that are in the local area of a school. And, you know, I could see increasingly that businesses and the kind of idea of this servant leadership, the idea that companies want to sell, not just to millennials who have a more strongly formed sense of wanting to do good in the world and wanting to buy from companies that are doing good, but also, what is our impact? What is a school for? And I think it goes back to that question you asked first of all, what is school for? And how would it look if we thought about it as more of a network of people that our students get to meet and engage with that will then help them along their pathway to being more informed about what the real challenges they're going to face are when they leave. And I see that all the time in sort of careers work, is that, you know, we're talking to students about the same 10 courses at the same 10 universities worldwide that are popular. And yet, when it comes to the skills that the workforce actually need, it, it's not very often that they're learning the skills of programming or learning new coding languages at school. They're teaching themselves that online.
From my perspective as an educator in the UK, the rigidity of the national curriculum is what causes that. Why are we not having coding as a standard within school from a very young age? Why are we not learning as a matter of course about environmental activists? Why are we years behind where we should be? We should have a flexible, dynamic curriculum that can respond to not the needs of the world, but the events of the world, so that when this global crisis kicked off, we could be in the classroom the very next day with a group of students putting together projects around this topic.
Seeing students who weren't physically able to be at school, but they wanted to contribute to making masks, or they wanted to use the 3D printers that their schools had in order to do something that was of benefit right now. Where is that in our curriculum?
That's it. It's the rigidity of the factory model, unfortunately.
I think one of the other things that links in with that is the separation that we have in the curriculum, this sort of idea of discrete subjects, and then the idea that social responsibility or social entrepreneurship or whatever sort of co-curricular you're talking about is treated very much as an add-on. So it's something extra, it's something over and above. You know, I mean, I'd you look at an average student school report in the UK now, and it will be 9 subject reports, and then probably somewhere in the tutor comment, the last couple of lines, has taken part in the following after school clubs.
It should be front and centre.
Exactly.
Yeah, the letters that the university councils have to write are often that only voice, I think. And this is what speaks to the sort of the system, the structure not really being fit for the need, is that we are expected to give that holistic overview of an applicant and what kind of a person they are, what kind of a roommate they'd be, what kind of projects they'd be involved with once they got to university, whether they were a good person at heart, how they treated their siblings, things like that. And that's stuff that if you don't get to know that student, you'll never see that in a traditional school setting. You have to look very hard. You need time to be able to get that information from the student. So I love the idea of projects that allow those students' capabilities to shine and come center stage, so that we're not trying to sift through all the information about them, but it's there, their passion is there, front and center.
How can you possibly talk about a student's learning pathway, their knowledge, their understanding, the care they're given, the kind of citizen that they're becoming, if you don't know them? And unless you've taken that time to sit with that person and get to know them as a person and not just as a learner or as a name in a spreadsheet, how can you possibly pass comment on that? And I think we need to humanize education again. Oceris comes from the Latin verb to dare to do. And our motto is challenging thinking. Challenging thinking as in challenging the students to think, but also challenging traditional thinking as well. Challenging the way things have always been done. Why do we have to have it that way? I would say one of the fundamentals of Oceris is that we are working in a human network, in a collaborative culture of human beings who want the best for each other. We're building positive, meaningful relationships that push everybody forward and encourage everybody to be better people.
There's no sacred cows. You know, there's nothing that is sacrosanct or that can't be questioned or kind of broken down or ripped apart.
Well, this is it. This is what I wanted to do from the very beginning, from the very conception of we can do this differently. And what is it going to look like? What I didn't want to do was surround myself with a series of sycophants and nodding dogs who were just going to agree with everything that was said. I wanted to surround myself with people like Ben who weren't afraid to question the norms and to question ideas that each of us had and to actually say, actually, why are we doing that? Why are we doing that? Is that going to benefit the student? Is it going to make the best of the situation? Is it going to make the best of the school? If it's not, why are we doing it?
That's something I've come across working with Ben as well, is that, you know, you would ask the question often, Ben, are we doing this student that we've accepted who's struggling in the IB diploma a disservice by accepting them in the first place? And what can we do to service those students that are finding it harder to swim in what is a very, very demanding curriculum that has a lot of touch points, that a lot of coursework, a lot of deadlines? And I think it's really important that, yeah, you know, you're somebody and the kids know this. you've got their back first. And if the curriculum doesn't suit them, they know they can come and talk to you about it and you'll figure something out with them.
Fundamentally, it comes down to the fact that you have to design and build a curriculum to fit the student rather than trying to mould or fit the students to a kind of rigid structure or rigid curriculum, because that hasn't worked.
Come back to that very first question. If you could sort of hang on to one thing that you think has changed for the better during all of this, what would that be?
I saw a comment on an educators group that I'm part of the other day, and it's talking about distance learning and online learning and everything. And it was basically an appeal to teachers that a lot of students don't feel comfortable with this learning over Zoom or learning over Google Meets or all of these kinds of things. And it basically said, some students are not cut out for this way of learning, so cut them some slack. And I think what's really interesting is if you reverse that and you go back to kind of pre-coronavirus times, which, you know, seems like a long time now, even if it's only a few weeks, nobody was saying some kids just aren't cut out for school, cut them some slack. And I think if anything comes out of this idea that we accept, or it becomes more widely accepted, some students or some kids aren't cut out to learn in X, Y, or Z kind of way. And I think if we can take that from it, that's massive. I think the only worry is once things go back to, inverted commas, normal, I don't know.
I think we've got to be very careful not to slip back into, like you say, normal. We've got this opportunity where the sandbox has been leveled, and we've got this opportunity, not just in education, but in many areas within society, to create something new, to create something better. And I agree with Ben when he said some students are not cut out for learning via Zoom, but that was never said in the classroom. And it's this one-size-fits-all education model that we need to move away from. And actually what we need to do is create a system where we put the students and the teachers and the learning experience at the center of it, and those relationships get built, and the students get to show the best of themselves to the teachers, and it's the teacher judgment which guides the learning.
So what does this actually kind of look like? Does that mean a smaller classroom? Does that mean that we stop dividing students into sets or into streams? Does that mean that we stop with teaching to, you know, in these siloed subject areas? What does it actually look like? If I can drag that out a little bit more.
All of those things have to be up for grabs. I was just kind of thinking about what Tim said, and it kind of struck me a lot of the time. And, you know, whenever I've gone for a job interview, one of the things they've always asked about is, you've got 30 students in whatever class, how do you differentiate? And it's really interesting because we're thinking in terms of giving a student a different worksheet, but that student is still sat in the same room with the same teacher, moving by and large at the same pace as other students. And I think what's really interesting is if we can take this idea of differentiation, but really explode it. So differentiation can be, you know, a student doesn't have to be in the classroom, or a student can be working on a completely different project to a different set of assessment criteria that they themselves have come up with.
I think those ideas of lack of differentiation within education are built around these traditional models of conformity, and the fact that if we have this body of students here, they're learning science between 9 and 10, then we move them to there, then they're being taught English between 10 and 11. It kind of comes down to the bedrock of control and a conformity, that if we have a system that we rigorously control, we can control the output. But we're dealing with creative, fluid, dynamic human beings here, whereas actually what we should be doing is looking at each student as an individual. What are your interests? Which direction do you want to go in? What questions do you want to ask? Who do you want to work with? When do you want to work? Where do you want to work? And on a large numbers scale, I get that that's quite difficult. I understand that. So maybe we need to shrink down this idea of school and make it a kind of boutique style education.
I think one of the things that I would like to see, whether it's going to happen or not, I don't know. I suspect at some point it's inevitable, but a move away from a kind of model whereby we differentiate, because differentiation kind of implies that everybody's working within quite a similar structure towards, I guess we could call it kind of customization or personalization.
It's tailored learning, isn't it, really, that we're looking for? I've seen and worked with many skilled educators who, within the confines of their school and within the confines of their classroom, are able to do that and are able to tailor the learning experience to the students' preferences, whilst also allowing them that kind of that freedom and that fail-safe environment to have a go.
So if you can move and you can actually remove the confines of the classroom, then that model becomes even more powerful.
It does, absolutely. Because you find between four walls, really. And actually, if you remove that idea of a traditional classroom, then all of a sudden you expand the learning experience. And good educators, great educators, are not afraid to do that. What we want from our bosses that we work for is for our boss to say to us, okay, today, bring me the best game that you've got. Bring me your A game if you've got it. Bring me your B game. Bring me the best game you've got. And don't worry if it goes wrong, because I've got your back. Now, surely that's all we want for our students as well. That's what our students want to feel like. Have a go. Don't worry if it goes wrong. I've got your back.
Are there inspiring sort of educators that you've watched at work, or inspiring systems?
Yeah, I mean, I've been fortunate enough to work with a good handful of real world-class teachers. World-class teachers who, in any other industry in the world, would have been held aloft as a beacon of fabulous practice, where these teachers, they will set up a learning environment for their students. They'll get them to ask really interesting questions that will and often do move outside the curriculum. And they're not contained by the curriculum in that sense. And then what they'll do really interestingly is, once they set this environment and empowered the students, they then step back and they let the students get underway. I have a friend, Ashley Watson, fantastic. I used to work with her, just a fabulous educator. You know, she loves her subject. You see that come across in the classroom. I mean, even closer to home as well. I'm looking at my own wife homeschooling my 8-year-old daughter. And it's wonderful to see her putting into place these lovely learning experiences within the confines of a loose curriculum, and being able to kind of skirt the edges slightly, and just being able to sit back and not control and direct too much, but being able to sit back and allow the learning to happen in a very organic way.
In a lot of schools, a kind of culture is created where a student will sit there for an hour in a lesson and they won't necessarily learn anything, but they'll sort of smile and shuffle out at the end, and everybody's happy and all kind of boxes have been ticked. But to have a culture where a student can actually come up and say, look, Ben, that didn't work. I don't get it. And then to be able to say to that student, all right, well, this was what I was trying to teach you, or this is what we were trying to learn together. What would be a better way of doing it? And I've had kids design the second attempt at a lesson. And I think for a lot of teachers, that's something that can kind of push people out of their comfort zone a little bit, because a lot of us are kind of used to being the person in the room who's right. And I think being willing to accept that you're not necessarily right or doing it in the best way, that doesn't make you any less of a professional. I mean, I would argue the opposite, in fact.
I'll hold my hands up and say that for the first 18 months of my teaching career, I didn't do that. It was horrible for the students, and it was horrible.
I went longer than 18 months.
But it took me almost 2 years to realize that actually this is a one-way conversation, and that's not what teaching and learning is about. And it's only at that point that you have to have a big piece of humble pie, swallow your pride, and realize that you're the first learner in the classroom.
Ben, who inspires you as an educator?
One person who I will actually give a name check to. This was when I worked in Hong Kong a while back, and I had a colleague, Rod, who we both taught an integrated humanities class at the same time. So we'd open the whiteboard wall and we'd teach together. We'd have sort of 45 kids in this class, and he designed this superb unit. The only criterion for the students was that it focused on pirates and piracy. And they could then pick that up and run with it in any way that they wanted. So a lot of the, you know, a lot of the kids were based in Hong Kong. They would investigate sort of Legends of Pirates on the Outside Islands. Some of the other students would pick it up and talk about piracy in terms of digital piracy and copyright. And these were Year 8 kids. They picked it up and they ran with it in so many different directions. And it was, the lessons were horrific. They were chaos. But it was brilliant because it worked. And you would, you know, there should have been sort of 40 plus students in this room between the two of us. 10 of them would be off around the school doing something else. They'd wander off. They'd go and interview people, or you'd turn around and you'd look for somebody. Where are they? Are they making a video on the basketball court? Giving the kids that sort of freedom was fantastic, because I think at that stage in my career, I wasn't particularly comfortable with ceding that much control to essentially children. And then to see that it works, you know, I think that's quite liberating.
I bet those kids remember that pirate lesson. Well, those lessons, that unit for years as well.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully they do. The guy that I think is amazing is Hans Rosling from the Gapminder Foundation in Sweden. He talks about the idea that the world is actually not as bad as we think it is. And he makes a really interesting point, because he says most teachers, and this is kind of related very much to my subject, but most teachers, when they're teaching international development, are teaching students what the world was like when we were at school. So his argument is basically most students in school, when it comes to things like this, are learning stuff that's about 15 to 20 years out of date. He passed away last year, but the foundation is still going strong. So yeah, I think he's someone that's quite inspiring.
This episode, a bit like Ben's pirate class, was totally wide-ranging, not always easy to control, and still kept me utterly engaged. It took in so many different ideas that it's really difficult to sum up with a nice soundbite. But the main things that I take away from it were, things can and must be done with students at the heart of the design. Teachers are desperate to be trusted, to decide what their students need, and to be given time to ask what their students need. The right learning environment should serve each student individually. This is an urgent need in the post-COVID context, especially as everybody will come back to school on a different page than that which they left it on. There's also a growing consensus from educators that things need never go back to the way they were if they weren't working for teachers or students. It's up to all of us to decide what comes next with this new normality, and it's also up to us as educators to align ourselves and join forces with others who share our values. Auceris is just one group of motivated people working to make change, but there are many others, and if we consider ourselves lifelong learners, then it's up to us to start making inquiries. If any of this is of interest, you can begin with learning more about what Auceris is doing by visiting www.auceris.com. You can follow Tim on Twitter, @Auceris, and you can also read more from Ben at glopoib.wordpress.com. In episode 6, I talked to Corey Johnson, the executive director of a program called Imagine Scholar. The organization provides a unique, personalized education to promising and motivated youth from disadvantaged communities in South Africa. It's a fascinating discussion that examines what success really looks like and where it really comes from. See you next week. You can stay up to date on Piloted by following us on Instagram and Facebook at The Piloted Podcast, or you can say hi on Twitter, just @ThePiloted. Thanks for tuning in.